Hello and welcome to the Scholars Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, The Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit have collectively grossed billions of dollars in ticket sales, but can they also be a means to understand complex politics and international relations? Then, many say Lance Armstrong has betrayed the public with his scheme to deceive, but some scholars say deception is a normal part of everyday life, even biological. Others say there's a cost to our lies, even the white ones. We'll explore the truth about lying. The Lord of the Rings trilogy and its recent prequel, The Hobbit, have collectively grossed billions of dollars in ticket sales, and now companies are planning to exploit it for theme parks, video games, slot machines, other properties. But can The Lord of the Rings act as a means to understand complex politics in international relations? Our guest says that it can. Patrick James is a professor at University of Southern California, professor of international relations, and the director of the Center for International Studies. His book is called The International Relations of Middle Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. Welcome, Pat James.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Before we get into the actual politics of Middle Earth, why The Lord of the Rings rather than another narrative to try to explain the theories of international relations?
The short answer is its extraordinary completeness and complexity as a world. If you took all of Tolkien's writings, J.R.R. Tolkien being the author, and put them together, you would have the most completely specified fantasy world that has ever been created. For example, full languages that one can speak, details so accurate that you can chart phases of the moon at different points in the storyline, and they're absolutely correct. So the reason I say that is that the complexity of the story is enough to rival human history itself.
The Lord of the Rings has, I think you wrote in the book, 14 languages. How many different species and storylines and themes?
The answer is, depending upon how one would measure such things, literally thousands within the movies, right, which collectively in their extended versions were something like 11 hours long, major, significant, interesting characters and plot lines are literally not even mentioned at all. To film it properly, it would probably go on as a series for several years.
All right, so let's talk about those themes. Justice and order, that's a very big theme in international relations. How are these exemplified in The Lord of the Rings?
It is a constant struggle, Maria, between the two. Often the more of one you have, that is, the more orderly things get, the more unjust and vice versa. And we look at particular storylines and situations in Middle Earth to see how those things trade off, because a person reading the book, if you will, anyone picking this up and saying, I'd like to get a sense of what international relations is about, the very kinds of conundrums and trade-offs, and I can give examples as you like, that we struggle with in Middle Earth, the characters do, I misspoke, are right there for you and me in the real world. We have to make these decisions all the time. Let's get in a time machine and it's 1994. You are William Jefferson Clinton. You are extremely popular yourself, but you are in trouble with the public and the Congress is in the process of falling to the Republicans. Do you do the right thing in Rwanda, which is to send in a relatively small and cheap force to shut down the genocide? Or alternatively, do you forego justice and preserve your own political position by instead staying out of Rwanda and remembering that the public was still pretty mad about the debacle in Somalia? That question answers itself. Justice and order trading off against each other.
And what about in the book?
In the book, we see an extraordinary and very black and white struggle. This is not a book for people who like shades of gray in that there are very villainous villains and very virtuous heroes. But at the same time, there are flaws. And while there is an ultimate struggle between good and evil in this book, there are really interesting characters who have twists and turns in them. And if we wanted to concentrate on someone, probably the right place to start is Gollum / Sméagol, arguably the most interesting and messed up character in the book.
First of all, let's address the black and white issue. Because isn't it the case where scholars, especially political communication scholars like me, we want to get our audiences to think about things in gray? Does this black and white idea defeat that?
It's a wonderful throwback, Maria, to a world, and remember, much of this was written in the first half of the 20th century. This, in some ways, is an assault on moral relativism. If you read the story, you will see that the characters are often tormented. Boromir is a perfect example of this, who wants to preserve the safety of his people in the land of Gondor, but is also struggling with the means toward doing that. In his case, for instance, he finally gives in to his darker nature. He pays with his life. He endangers the entire mission, if you will, of the so-called Fellowship of the Ring. And there we see giving in to evil resulting in a very bad outcome.
So you mentioned Gollum, and you said he exemplifies.
He exemplifies within, I think, human nature that there is no absolute determinism, that all of us have the potential for good or evil. Most of our listeners will have a sense of who Gollum is, that he's this extraordinary high-tech character who has a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Smeagol is who he once was originally. He's akin to the delightful little hobbit creatures who are among the most important protagonists. He also has this darker side called Gollum, who is obsessed with the very evil ring of power that jeopardizes the safety of the entire world. And often throughout the story, crucial developments go back and forth in terms of whether the Smeagol part can stay strong enough to assist the Fellowship's members, Frodo in particular, a character we also can talk about, or whether, regrettably, the darker side of Gollum takes over and threatens the world.
You've also written in the book about how Gollum actually represents a certain paradigm or model in international relations. It's the imperialist model. How is that so?
In the storyline, very briefly, Gollum murders another character named Deagle, who is a friend, when they're fishing. Deagle finds the ring. The first act of evil that the ring causes, because of its own inherent evil, is the murder of Smeagol by Gollum. Well, what does that have to do with colonialism? The river folk are simple creatures who live by the river, like to fish, would never hurt anyone. Yet when this high-tech device, arguably, in the fantasy world of Middle-earth, the ring is the WMD, right? It's the weapon of mass destruction. As soon as it is injected into the simple location of the river folk, what happens? Gollum murders his friend. He's obsessed with the ring. He uses its magical powers to disappear, and he becomes cannibalistic, horrendous, and ultimately over 500 years of unnatural extended life due to the fact that he has the ring. He commits many heinous acts. This can be seen as a, if you will, a comparison to the effects of very high technologies going into parts of the world that were innocent and pristine and causing terrible things to happen. Some people have read the book that way.
So now that's one of the many ways of looking at international relations, and you have characters representing the other models, realism, for example, the liberalism. Who do you see as representing realism?
Realism, a particular form of it that's very aggressive, called offensive realism. It's a sense that people live for the gain of power relative to others, that they want to expand, if you will, that they're naturally quite imperialistic. A storyline example involving the two wizards, Saruman, who's gone over to the dark side and is starting to help the Dark Lord and scheme with him. He's been overtaken by Sauron's rising power, versus Gandalf, who is the unofficial leader of the free peoples who resist Sauron. They have a terrible confrontation, and a concept such as bandwagoning plays a key role in offensive realism, as in, it is appropriate for me to bandwagon, that is, roll down the hill and join the side that's winning. Saruman, if makes a long, impassioned plea to Gandalf, which is really extremely dishonest and sneaky, of course, as in, we should join Sauron. He's going to win anyway. Let's do that. This communicates a very old concept and one with a lot of staying power in international relations, that we see bandwagoning. For example, smaller states that joined in with Hitler's Germany, during its early days of successful conquest, certain parties join in with Hitler rather than balancing against him. Saruman, the wizard who's gone over to the dark side, bandwagons with the evil and incredibly powerful Sauron, whereas Gandalf speaks for another version of realism called balancing, as in, both are about power, but it's about how you choose to deploy your power. Saruman says, let's cave in and divide up the spoils of Sauron. Gandalf says, very unwise, let us balance against him because he does not share power.
Now, you said that Gandalf, in the book, was actually a representative of what we call in political science rational choice. And yet, wouldn't a rational choice person want to bandwagon with the side that's winning?
If they calculate properly, the correct answer is no, interestingly enough, because they also can look ahead rather than being myopic and say, what Gandalf did, as in, it might sound great to be on the so-called winning team, But siding with someone like Hitler that is bandwagoning with him or Sauron in the fantasy world is a lot like feeding a crocodile, hoping that he will eat you last. So the rational thing to do is to actually join the weaker side and try to balance, because either you must, as one of the American revolutionaries said, you must hang together or hang separately.
My favorite model is constructivism. How can we see the international relations theory of constructivism in The Lord of the Rings?
The answer is we see it in so many places. Constructivism is about studying ideas and saying, hey, you know what? It's not just guns and tanks and planes or even nuclear weapons that matter. It's the power of ideas. And if we look at the story of The Lord of the Rings, here's one example of this. Frodo, who is the ring bearer, is looking at the world around him, and you'll notice we can introduce multiple theories with a single character. He has to come up with an idea about what his world is all about. Is it about black and white, good and evil? He must, in other words, construct the world. And as he grew up, if you will, in this very idealistic sort of throwback to early modern England, very pastoral place called the Shire, right? Everybody farms. There's no ugly machinery or industry. He must reconstruct his view, because here's his initial view until he begins to have his adventures and gets involved in the Lord of the Rings story. Who cares about the outside world? It doesn't concern us here in the Shire. Many would call that a construction of isolationism. Whereas he begins to construct a more liberal, cooperative worldview, as in, I must join in with this fellowship, because even though we hobbits, we little wee creatures who live in our simple shire, would like to stay there and we'd like to be left alone, that isn't realistic anymore. So he learns and he discovers and he changes his worldview, and so too do other companions of his. There's a famous line, I think one that people really like, from the Two Towers movie and book, where one of Frodo's hobbit companions is speaking to this living tree-type creature called an ent, and they're trying desperately to persuade these ents, who could be quite helpful to the free peoples, to come into things, and the ents are hedging, and they're not sure that this concerns them, and the character Pippin shouts, "You're part of this world," and it causes the ents to look back at themselves as in they had actually allowed themselves to fall out of it. They had constructed a shell around themselves, but here's the problem. It doesn't always hold true. The shell can break down, and the forest's burned.
And it's all interconnected.
It is interconnected. It is interdependent, as the so-called liberal theorists of IR would tell us. Do not try to pretend, especially, Maria, under conditions of globalization, that there are little airtight compartments in this world and we can stay in one and keep the rest of them out.
Let me just remind listeners that we are speaking with Patrick James, and the book is called The International Relations of Middle Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. And this is The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. There are other models, then. You actually have found a character for almost every one of them. The critical theory. How do you find critical theory in The Lord of the Rings?
Critical theory, to give you a very basic sense of what it's all about, is not, say, in the sense of Newton or Galileo trying to explain our universe like a natural scientist would, but instead it's looking at IR more as a philosopher might in terms of what is right and wrong. So how in this fantasy world, and bear in mind Tolkien, who wrote this material, wrote all of it before anybody even used the words critical theory. What's so fascinating about his fantasy world is that you will find theories that have been created very recently, long after his death in the mid-1970s, that, amazingly enough, storylines represent. A great character to talk about here is someone who doesn't make it into the movies, and his name is Old Man Willow. He's kind of a cantankerous cousin to the Ents. The Ents are these large, mobile, tree-like creatures who ultimately, by the way, do join the good guys and help out. Old Man Willow actually is really quite nasty and mean. And in a storyline that's left out, we see him trying to devour the little hobbits early in their time away from the Shire. They're still quite ignorant of the outside world. They tend to be innocents. They might lie down near the roots of the tree. And then, unfortunately, because they are not aware of such things, they risk being devoured and gnarled to death. Well, then where does critical theory come in? To Old Man Willow, intruders in his domain called the Old Forest always mean trouble. What do they do? They burn the trees. They chop them down. This, of course, is critical theory expressed in terms of environmentalism. Old Man Willow seems like a villain, doesn't he? He's trying to devour these hobbits. But now we transport ourselves to his domain. What is happening to him? people are coming into his territory, even right next to his doorstep, and they're pulling out axes and cutting him or his relatives down. And what the book does is, Old Man Willow is a sentient creature. So it encourages us, from a critical theory standpoint, to step out of the idea that trees are just wood waiting to happen for our fireplace. Maybe, for example, we might want to rethink what we're doing with the Amazon.
And then also it brings in the issues of justice and the entire system and how the system works to be either just or unjust, and feeds into conflict.
You are absolutely right. And the book is also a wonderful and interesting struggle between myself and my wonderful collaborator, Abigail Ruane. Mm-hmm. She's a very fine scholar. She is more devoted to critical theory, whereas I am much more on the sort of, call it, if you will, natural science side of things. She's more interested in justice. I'm more interested in order, not to the exclusion of the other.
I assume then that it was your co-author that actually integrated feminism.
Yes. We're obviously as different as you could get in our approaches. So each one serves as a naturally wonderful critic for the other. So the book tends to have, in my humble opinion, a very pragmatic and balanced sense between order and justice. As in, we do not obsess over justice to the point where we worry that everybody always has the same things all of the time. And at the same time, we're not so callous that we want order badly enough that we don't care if one person has everything. The tricky thing, as we know in the real world, Maria, is where is that appropriate balance in any given context?
And do you have a sense that The Lord of the Rings allows that debate to come through?
Precisely, because if you look at the hierarchy of power, you have different races, if you will, call them ethnicities more in our term. You have the humans, you have the elves, who are very long-lived, extremely intellectual, erudite, very distant. Also, they have flaws, such as being condescending and somewhat self-absorbed. At the other end of things, you have the hobbits, who are pint-sized, physically not very strong, and generally not very knowledgeable, with a few exceptions about the outside world. And then much more fantastic creatures, dwarves, for instance, who are short, but actually physically quite powerful, incredible engineers, but here's their flaw: they are obsessed with wealth. Notice the problem here, that they might not care much about justice as long as they have a lot. And then you have characters that go over the edge into evil, the so-called orcs, and here we come back to the question of moral relativism, are in fact completely evil. They have no redeeming characteristics, and that, of course, is a very extreme kind of character to have. They are Sauron's perverted creations from tormented, perverted elves.
And the orcs you described as part of the realist model prototype. How are they?
There is a memorably evil character who has a very exciting confrontation in the movie version with Aragorn, one of the most heroic characters we haven't mentioned. He is the king-in-waiting, the leader of the free peoples. He has a confrontation with the leader of a particular type of hybrid orc, very powerful, stronger than normal orcs, larger, and capable of traveling in daylight. These rather miserable and abominable creatures abhor the sun, and the particular type of orc called the Uruk-hai does not. And the Uruk-hai leader epitomizes realism in that he goes on a murderous rampage. All he cares about offensively, destroying his enemies. In other words, he's monomaniacal. He wants power. He wants to destroy things. He does not have any concerns for justice. To him, the order is the Uruk-hai dominate and the free peoples are to be destroyed.
He almost sounds like he belongs in another model, in the traditional imperialist model.
Yes, which is essentially a historical type of version of offensive realism, in that in the high era of imperialism in the 19th century, the great powers of Europe sailed the seas, took over what they, in a kind of bad reading of Charles Darwin, saw as extremely inferior people, colonized them. They didn't understand the places they were colonizing very well. But you can look at a sort of neo-colonial type of assessment through these rampages, in particular going into places and savaging them that had previously been undisturbed. Another storyline, Maria, that is not in the movies, a very dark episode that would have been anticlimactic had it been filmed. It's called The Scouring of the Shire, if you read The Lord of the Rings. What happens, sadly enough for the hobbits, when the hobbits go back home to their idyllic shire, it is not like it is in the movie. In the book, it has been taken over by a decrepit, pathetic, reduced version of the evil Saruman, who I mentioned a few minutes ago. He and his minions have now, and get this point closely, they have created an ugly industrial shire. It's filthy, it's polluted, it's beautiful trees, it's wonderful meadows are full of industrial waste. There's smoke everywhere. In a sense, what this is pointing out also about war and its consequences is there is no victory without also loss. That the Shire, when they come back, they have to fight another rearguard battle to destroy Saruman's occupying force of evil men. And they do. The hobbits are now, because of their battle-hardened experience, able to come back. The four of them who return to the Shire from the Great Adventure, they come back, they lead a hobbit rebellion. Things are repaired, but some hobbits have died, and some beautiful things. In particular, if you recall the bridge between the hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, the party where Bilbo leaves. There is something called the party tree. It's a big, beautiful tree. It has been destroyed and turned into firewood.
I know you said your co-author wrote the feminist chapter, but I wonder, Lord of the Rings didn't have much presence of women at all. And I wonder if that is part of the feminist critique of international relations theory as well.
Well said. In fact, to give the women even a smidgen of airtime, they actually have to change some storylines. In the book, for instance, there's a memorable rescue scene where the character Arwen, who is the, if you will, the partner ultimately for Aragorn, the king, she's an elf, and she does not rescue Frodo from the Dark Riders, these minions of Sauron, when he's been stabbed. He's going to turn into, if you will, a sort of ghastly zombie-like creature. He needs desperately to get to where the elves have their sanctuary and their very powerful medicine. He's rescued by the beautiful Arwen in the movie, but a character, a male elf actually, named Glorfindel rescues Frodo in the book version. Arwen's character, for example, is really pumped up in the movies compared to what she would be in the books. And few female characters that really matter. Galadriel is not, if you will, exaggerated. We haven't mentioned her yet. She is arguably the most powerful single entity in Middle-earth. She's an elf and an ancient one. Unless Sauron can get that ring we've been talking about, if he gets it, all of the world falls to him. Galadriel possesses a second-tier ring and is incredibly powerful, very wise, has some elements of mind-reading powers as well. That's implied. She's powerful and important. Eowyn is the leading feminist character in the book. It's actually quite fascinating to think of how long ago this book was written. And she is as close as you could get to being a sort of female Ivanhoe knight-like character. She wants to fight alongside the men. She's quite vigorous and capable of doing so, but they won't let her. She actually has to disguise herself and assume the identity of a phony knight called Durnhelm. She becomes a warrior from her kingdom, Rohan. Rohan being allied with Gondor, the principal kingdom that we've been talking about. The Rohan people are riders. They're very Norse. They remind you, if you will, of people who would live in a Viking type of environment, and they're great horsemen, and she actually has to disguise herself, and she plays a crucial role in a very late battle scene in the movie. If she isn't there, there's a saying about these horrible black riders that were pursuing Frodo at one point. The leader of them cannot be killed by a man. He is ultimately slain by Eowyn and a small hobbit who was not going to be allowed to fight either. And they, in other words, the feminist critique is there are women who can do things that men can do. Now here's where some of my feminist friends would get annoyed and say, wait, you left out something. This is called liberal feminism. The idea is that you and I should have equal opportunities, as should everyone, and you might then try to excel in the ways I might try to excel. Different variants or strands of feminism actually object to this, say, no, women actually are different, and here we get into another storyline, if that's all right, that's not in the movies, in the books. The Entwives. Remember I mentioned those large, fantastic living trees? They're all guys. They're all masculine, because the Entwives left. They found the Ents and their obsession with trees annoying. The Entwives thought that gardens were more exciting. There, notice the environmentalism again, but notice also, although Tolkien could not possibly have anticipated this, one strand of feminism argues that the liberal model, where everybody should just have an equal opportunity and try to excel, say, in a democratic capitalist type of society, that's one kind of feminism. But another one would say, we want to be different. Actually, we don't want to obsess over what you historically have obsessed over. We have different goals. Even those nuances can be found, and I return to my first point, how many novels out there have this degree of internal complexity where we can get into subvariants of explanations of our world, and we find entire characters or races that help us with them.
And speaking of complexity, the other aspect of this book, the levels of looking at, you call them levels of analysis, it's kind of a scholarly term, how to really understand conflict. You said in The Lord of the Rings, just like in World War I, you can look at it from these various perspectives. You can look at the big system, like what are the systemic reasons why World War I happened, similar in The Lord of the Rings. You can look at it from the kind of structural elements, like the state, and you can look at it from the individual, like the young man who decided to shoot the Archduke.
That's right. And what's so fascinating, I'll just give one historical comparison. If you look at things that are true to all three of the wars that we choose to look at, they're very well-known cases. Obviously, the War of the Ring from the fantasy world. Why did it happen? And then the causes as well of the World War I that you just mentioned, but also the war in Iraq, which is more recent in our times. One of the things that is in The Lord of the Rings, as well as those other two cases, people have argued that the wars were precipitated by weak and or experienced and or bad leaders, quote unquote, who showed poor judgment. World War I, we have a combination of decrepit empires and monarchical systems where it wasn't the best and the brightest, right, who are in leadership. It was old, decrepit monarchs like the Kaiser, for instance, in Germany, the Tsar in Russia, who, because they are there only through privilege and not competence, are really not very skilled in diplomacy, not very able to prevent the outbreak of World War I after that assassination you referred to. Now, Iraq, not a partisan statement, but I think it has been said fairly that George Bush, 43, was not an experienced foreign policy president. He tended to listen, arguably, to people who really wanted to precipitate the war. Perhaps he moved impetuously without appropriate evidence regarding WMDs. That can be seen as weak and inexperienced leadership. Later on, the intelligence was proven not to have been there. Now, here's the fun part. If you're trying to get these ideas and compare them, The Lord of the Rings has its own decrepitude to talk about as well. Remember Gandalf, the leader of the Free Peoples? Actually, he has no official position. Other leaders won't listen to him. The two monarchs from the kingdoms I have referenced, Rohan and Gondor, they have, in one case, Gondor is the more powerful of the two Free People's kingdoms. They have Denethor, who has gone mad. He has been seduced, if you will, by the evil of Sauron. The leader of Rohan has been bewitched by an agent of Saruman, another wizard who I had mentioned. Gandalf is fighting furiously. He's pursuing diplomacy to get these weaker, incompetent leaders to listen to him, as in, we're going to be really in a deep, dark place if we do not prepare properly for the war that's coming. And for various kinds of complex reasons, the incompetence weakens the free people and makes them more prone to a war they will lose. Notice that the comparison with Iraq and 1914 is really quite apt. You've got weak leadership and incompetence, and war ensues. Now, one might say, hey, Tolkien cheated. He was making this all up about World War I. If he was still alive, he would get quite cranky with us for saying this. But how about that? You can't say anything about Iraq. He never saw Iraq. It happened 30 years after he was gone.
I'd like to end with what you began the book with, which is in this most recent election in Iran, that when there was considerable consternation about how the election went, that the state aired The Lord of the Rings in an effort to pacify people, but it didn't have that effect. What happened?
The tremendous irony is that while the state, the Ahmadinejad regime, says, well, let's throw the people a bone. They don't get many Western movies. These movies are hotter than the sun. Everybody's watching. This is, of course, years after they came out in the West, right? They come out in the early 2000s. This is 2009. Here's the irony. The state puts the movies out there, but they should have had some of their own people watch them very carefully first, because what the movies do, more than anything else, the movies are about human or personal freedom. They argue in favor of democracy and honest practices and fair treatment, as in a combination of order and justice. They would hardly be something you would show people to try to calm them down. And what happens, of course, is a boomerang effect. People look at these movies, and they see messages within them as in, we ought to resist. You know, we shouldn't be pacified by this. Yes, we're entertained. Of course, it's a sword and sorcery fantasy movie. Arguably, it's the best long movie ever made. The Return of the King won Best Picture. So it's a great action movie, and yes, they were right to entertain, but I think they would have been better off showing Top Gun or something out of Schwarzenegger if they wanted to shut people down.
Well, thank you so much, Patrick James, for being with us. Again, the book is called The International Relations of Middle-Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. This has been the Scholar Circle. When we come back, what is the truth about lying? Stay tuned.
Well, she's fashionably lean, and she's fashionably late. She'll never rank a scene, she'll never break a day. But she's no drag, just watch the way she walks. She's a 20th century fox. She's a 20th century fox. No tears, no fears, no ruin.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Lance Armstrong's fans and supporters expressed a sense of deep betrayal since the biking champion finally confessed to his widespread scheme to deceive sporting officials and the public. But some scholars say that deception is ubiquitous and normal in all human interactions, that lying is useful and possibly even biological. Others suggest that there is a cost to lying, even for white lies. What is the truth about lying? We have three experts with us. Cicela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, Secrets on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, and A Strategy for Peace, Human Values and the Threat of War. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave and Exterminate Others, and Hidden Conversations, An Introduction to Communicative Psychoanalysis. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Two of you, you've argued that deception is essentially ubiquitous, possibly even natural, biological. Cicela Bach, you argue that while that may be so, it's rarely justifiable and has a cost. Maybe we should start by distinguishing the kinds of deception and lies and where they occur. Cicela Bach, what do we need to know to understand lying and deception?
There are so many different kinds that take place in so many different circumstances, but then there are some cases that come before the public that really reveal a great many of them. And I would say, for instance, President Clinton and all that was discussed about his deception and his various forms of lying and also probably his forms of self-deception, that was so interesting because people in the public had a chance to see a person saying one thing and then saying the opposite. Now we have Lance Armstrong, and he, to us scholars, I believe, perhaps I speak for all three of us, it's particularly interesting to hear his testimony about what went on, how ubiquitous it was indeed, how much he did, and how he now regrets it, how he got into it. So I'm fascinated by that case.
And how he justified it as well.
How he justified it for a while no longer can.
David Livingston Smith.
There are a number of forms of deception, many of which we don't really tend to identify as deception. We call them tact, or when we deceive our children, we call it preserving the magic of childhood, and so on and so forth. So there are various descriptions that we use to soften the raw fact that we deceive one another a good deal of the time. A very important dimension here with regard to deception is, of course, the moral significance of deceptions. Deceptions are far more morally significant than others.
Such as?
Such as, well, the way you see this depends on the moral theory you're operating with, but of course, some deceptions are morally consequential, and those are not necessarily negatively morally consequential. So there are situations in which deception is morally obligatory. You know, it's something that we should do. We would be wrong if we were not lying and deceiving. And there are other situations in which deception is morally wrong, that it's destructive, it's hurtful, it's contrary to human flourishing.
Now, as I recall, one of you said that this is the paradoxical aspect of lying. Lies can damage, but so can truth. What do you think we need to know? Charles Ford?
Deception and self-deception are ubiquitous. To say that does not make it morally right, however. It's just merely a fact of life. And I should say not just of human life, but truly throughout the entire biological world. Now, again, in regards to whether it's right or wrong, that's an entirely different issue, and I can only speak from my own personal view, but that is that a deception that harms another person is morally wrong. And sometimes, I got this from Dr. Bach's writings, sometimes we lie supposedly to help another person, but what we're really doing is lying to kind of help ourselves so that we don't have to deal with the discomfort, such as a physician lying to a dying person. Is that really for the person who is dying who may actually wish the truth, or is it so that we don't feel so bad about it ourselves?
Cicely Bach, this is your bailiwick.
I certainly agree with Charles Ford that there is a lot of what we might call deception, though it could be a euphemism, going on even in the cellular world, so to speak, and certainly among animals. It's not the same as lying. Some people have argued that only human beings can really straight out lie. But then the question of lying to the dying, when I wrote my book, Lying, which actually came out in 1978, the first edition, it was common for doctors to lie, especially to dying patients and especially to those who had cancer. By now, and in part, maybe my book had something to do with it, American Medical Association has changed its rules, and it's very clear that people on the whole want to be told the truth. But then there is a way of telling the truth, and I think that is what Professor Smith was saying. Sometimes it can be very destructive to tell the truth in such a way, and doctors can do it. Oh, yes, you have cancer. Goodbye. I'm leaving now. That form of telling the truth is very destructive. That does not mean, though, that you have to lie. Instead, I argue in my book Secrets that there is a whole region of learning to understand people, learning how to speak to them, not lying, but at the same time caring about their response enough so that you don't tell the truth destructively.
I really scoured the literature to try to find research that spoke to perhaps there are certain realms where lying does not occur. From the other two scholars, it sounds like it really is ubiquitous throughout life. Is there something that I missed in the literature that shows there are certain areas of life where it doesn't occur?
Well, there certainly are areas where one can keep it to a minimum. And there, I think what Professor Smith mentioned, the questions of tact and magic of childhood, preserving that, etc. There are ways of speaking that I wouldn't call lying, actually, at all. For example, even, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Well, nobody expects you to tell about your recent medical problems. So I don't regard that as lying at all. Then I also think what Gandhi said was so important. He taught about and wrote about truthfulness and nonviolence. And he said that the way to start addressing those really is in one's personal life, to try to create regions with one's family, with one's friends, at one's work, where one really tries to cut down as much as possible on the various forms of deception.
We have this idea that this is ubiquitous not just in humanity, but in nature. Charles Ford, why is it in nature, and how useful is it, and does that mean that it has to be in humanity?
When we look at this from a biological perspective, essentially all animals, and there may be a few exceptions, but essentially all animals are either predators or prey. And therefore, the question becomes, how can you obtain a meal in order to live another day? Or how can you avoid being prey and therefore living another day? And so you have this continuous arms race between predator and prey of how can one outsmart the other in an order to either get a meal or avoid being a meal. Now, to some extent, that happens with humans also. And very unfortunately, I would say, and perhaps more currently in our culture right now than when I was a child, there is an enormous amount of competition. And one of the ways that you can compete is, unfortunately, by deception. And that, again, I would emphasize, does not make it morally right and does not rationalize it, but it is a fact that that is one way that you can get ahead. Now, if you're caught, of course, then you have lost all that advantage, you've lost all that power, and you may be shunned by others.
So it is an act of manipulation in both the animal kingdom and in human relations.
If I can step in here, and this is Sisala Bach again, to say it certainly is true, for instance, that birds send deceptive signals. There are all kinds of things happening in the animal kingdom of just that nature. But of course, birds cannot stop to think about what might happen to me as a person with a conscience if I lie, and if I lie a lot. And that is why it's so interesting among human beings that on the whole, the ones who have been caught, as Professor Ford mentioned, regret very much that they got into it in the first place. And there are so many examples of how people just sometimes slip into something, and then they feel they have to protect the original lie, and they go on, and all of a sudden they can't get out. And then on the whole, they do regret it, if you ask them. Not everybody. There are some people who are totally callous.
That actually brings up something that David Livingstone Smith has written about, which is the unconscious, conscious parts of the brain. Can you help us to understand this process?
There's a lot of hype about neuropsychology, but in fact, we don't have much of a clue of how neural processes result in mental processes or embodimental processes. But I don't think that's really what you're getting at. I think the issue here is how we represent the world to ourselves. And this really introduces a whole new dimension to this discussion. By and large, when we talk about lying and deception, we think of someone who knows, who is aware of what is true, and who intentionally misrepresents that truth to others for purposes of personal gain. But often it doesn't work that way. Often it's the case that we misrepresent the world to ourselves initially, and then broadcast that misrepresentation to others. As it happens, some of these misrepresentations to ourselves are self-serving. So we can, in this way, sort of be in bad faith in good faith. I think that quite an important distinction between the sorts of deception that's consequent upon self-deception and the sort of deception which is intentional and strategic and calculated. And by the way, if we're looking at non-human organisms, it's not just animals. I mean, it's plants, it's even microorganisms that deceive. But of course, they don't deceive in this intentional fashion. Their deceptive properties are built into automatic behavioral routines or their morphology or so on and so forth.
Well, this brings up a couple of things that I'd like to go into. One, I believe, David Livingstone Smith, this was also in your work, and this pertained to how people self-deceive in order to remain happy. I believe you called it to remain mentally healthy, while depressed people tended to be more accurate. It made me wonder about the definition of mental health.
A lot of this sort of language is normative, moralizing language dressed up as medical language. We have these ideals of how people should be, and we call those healthy. And we have ideas about how people shouldn't be, and we call them sick. Our notions of mental health, well, it's been shown that they correlate to a significant degree to levels of self-deception. There's optimal self-deception. The world is a rough place. We're all going to die. Everyone we love is going to die. A lot of the world lives in misery, and we buy our clothes from companies that employ virtual slave labor and so on. There's a lot that we close our eyes to in order to maintain a certain sort of mental equilibrium. And we call that healthy.
Charles Ford, you've talked about these other aspects of self-deception, like false memory syndrome. What is that, and what are the consequences?
The false memory syndrome actually are memories that people have, I should say memories in quote, which have been suggested by other people, and then it becomes their belief. Many people are very suggestible, but all of us have this tendency to remember things differently each time we bring it back into consciousness. Now, when we sit down at the computer and we have a program such as Word and we type something in, and it'll ask us when we push save, do we want to save the original? Do we want it with the changes? Unfortunately, our memory doesn't allow us to save the original. It always goes back in with all of the changes that occurred according to whatever emotional state we were in at the time that we had the memory return. This sounds complex. It's actually relatively simple and was beautifully explicated by Elizabeth Loftus, and it's what I call the malleability of memory. It's one of the dangers of psychotherapy, where someone can suddenly have memories of things that never occurred. I wanted to go back, though, and respond to something that Dr. Bach had said, that people who lie and are caught are often very regretful that they had lied. I'm not sure that I would agree with that in toto, and certainly many of the people that I see are very regretful. Yes, they're regretful that they got caught, not necessarily that they lost.
Absolutely, and certainly that is what Lance Armstrong said first, absolutely. And then he wished he hadn't done all that he had done, but you're quite right. Getting caught is one of the things that is not anticipated often by people who lie a lot, and yet that is distressing in the extreme.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about deception. Cicela Bach, let's bring you back in here. If, in fact, lying is commonplace, how do we build trust in relationships, in society, with our leaders, with our athletes?
Well, I would argue first that it's too easy to say lying is ubiquitous. We have, in this discussion, talked about various forms of self-deception, all kinds of sort of marginal states. And so I think it is easy, actually, for people to begin to think about drawing those distinctions and to think about themselves, the kind of person they would prefer to be. But here I just have to quote a wonderful statement by Bertrand Russell. This comes back to self-deception. Every man, wherever he goes, is encompassed by a cloud of comforting convictions which move with him like flies on a summer day. I would argue that that's probably true. That doesn't mean that we can't try to cut back and cut back and cut back. Of course, we will always have a certain amount of self-deception. I like the expression, I think, from Professor Smith, of misrepresenting ourselves to ourselves and misrepresenting our world to ourselves. But we can try to straighten that out a little bit and work at it. And here I see a big difference in research between, on the one hand, psychologists who tend to more or less dismiss some of the moral problems, not necessarily the psychologist speaking here, and on the other hand, philosophers who take much more seriously the idea of trying to be as honest as you can with yourself.
Is trust the basis of relationships, and is there a cost to these various forms of deception?
I do believe there is a great cost, and this again is something that people realize only when they've squandered trust. They have betrayed people, they have betrayed themselves, no longer can they be trusted, and so that indeed is something that they often recognize too late. But that's where I also want to bring in the two perspectives we have. On the one hand, there is the perspective we can completely understand of people who need to get along in the world, and they are going to often do so by lying, in part because they don't quite see the problems that they may get into, and they don't see in particular the damage it does to themselves and to the trust that they're held in. And you can see that in marriages, you can see it between parents and children, among friends. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is that of people who have been deceived and who know just what's meant by this idea of no longer trusting a person. So my suggestion in my book, Lying, was, and I still agree with that, we really need to share both of the perspectives. We need to think, if we can, before we slip into an entire practice of lying, think of the perspective of those other people and what they will feel and whether they will trust us again.
I'd like to bring Charles Ford back in for a moment. What about this idea of cognitive dissonance? Does that come in when we deal with these various kinds of lies or deception?
At times when people lie, there really is that type of internal conflict where they are trying to hold two disparate facts or two disparate ideas in their mind at the same time. My perspective on lying and the way that I became interested in this is probably somewhat different from the two other guests in the show. And that is, I became fascinated with the phenomenon of pathological lying, of people who lied continuously even when it didn't serve them any useful purpose. And so I worked backwards from that. I worked backwards from the very pathological to try to see what that would tell us about normal, quotes normal people. I'm not sure anybody's completely normal. And what I had found is that those people with pathological lying are people that we might describe as having disorders of the self. That's kind of a technical term. Another way of describing it is saying they're very narcissistic people. And one of the characteristics of narcissistic people is that they have very little empathy towards others and often very little understanding of how others think and feel. And that's why I was trying to get to the idea that often these people don't have a great deal of conscience. They don't have a great deal of regret over what has occurred with lying because the world revolves around them anyway. Now, if all people had a sense of right and wrong that was internalized, and the primary value was their care about other people, then there would be a much greater level of trust and of honesty.
David Livingston Smith.
I think this is a slightly rosy picture. I mean, we're in the happy situation of primarily agreeing with one another, all three of us, but I do think this is a bit rosy. I think it would be actually quite nightmarish if people did not lie to one another on a regular and daily basis. Lying greases the wheels of social interaction. Now, I'm using lying in a very broad sense here. Some people want to confine lying to a very narrow, deliberate telling of untruth. I'm wanting to use it in a broader sense. You can call it deception, if you will. I think our lives depend on it. Our social lives depend on it, and our personal lives depend on a measure of self-deception. And as I mentioned before, there are situations in which lying is the morally right thing to do. Deception is the morally right thing to do. So I think we have to make a distinction between the sorts of deception that are necessary for us to find one another bearable, and indeed to trust one another to some degree, and the surplus deceptions. I think the surplus deceptions, that's what we find in cases like Bill Clinton and Lance Armstrong and so on, the unnecessary deceptions. And those are the ones we should really be especially concerned about.
Cicela Buck?
If I may step in here, the business of saying that we lie all the time, and I'm really in agreement with Professor Smith that that's a very, very broad definition. And it reminds me when my book Lying came out in 1978, Time magazine had an article which purported to have scholars saying that we lie hundreds of times. Everybody lies hundreds of times a day. Well, I wrote to Time and asked about those people and what are they talking about? Turned out that they were talking about such things as smiling to somebody that you see in the elevator, that all kinds of things to them seemed to be lying. And I think that it's extremely important as people think about deception and lying to try to sort out the different kinds, to notice that smiling is not lying, for instance. And that will help with coming to grips with this question of whether when lying might be acceptable. Wow. I would argue that that is very rare, but it can definitely happen when you're trying to save somebody's life, for instance.
I'd like to come back to that because I don't think it's obvious what a lie is and what a lie isn't. And we can give narrow definitions and broad definitions of it. I think there's some advantage to being rather liberal about what a lie is, because we tend to self-servingly constrain lies to certain sorts of very deliberate misrepresentations. And that kind of lets us off the hook.
Charles Ford?
We have a very complex subject which we can look at from multiple angles, and I think that it is not that anyone is right or wrong. I think we are just merely looking at the subject from different perspectives.
The one thing we did not talk about that I wanted to get into, the psychobiological aspect of deception. David Livingston Smith, is this something that you would like to do?
Sure. I mean, amongst non-human organisms, deception is so common, it's virtually universal. Organisms deceive by their behavioral routines, by their form, their morphology, by their coloration. It is really extraordinarily common. Even organisms without a nervous system, certain sorts of plants that deceive wasps and bees into pollinating them, it's very, very pervasive.
From the human neurobiological standpoint, we have learned a great deal over the last 15 years in terms of the functional neuroimaging of the brain. In other words, we can tell what parts of the brain are activated when a person tells the truth, and there's a difference when they are telling an untruth, and yet a different activation when they're withholding the truth. And basically what these findings are, without going into the details, are that it requires more brain activation to lie than it does to tell the truth.
I would wonder if that would be part of where the cognitive dissonance comes in.
Well, some people are very successful, however, in suppressing half of the conflict that would cause cognitive dissonance.
Well, let's leave it there then. Charles Ford, David Livingston Smith, and Cicela Bach, thank you, all three of you, for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thanks to my both.
Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Cicela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarcircle.org. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.